Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and today I'm joined by someone who had a much longer playoff experience than he has in the past covering the Canucks, just because they really haven't made the playoffs for a long time. The one and only Harmon Dial of The Athletic. Thanks so much for taking the time. I think this is the third time you've joined us. How was your spring covering the Canucks this year?
It was wild. It was exhilarating. I don't really count the 2020 bubble as a quote unquote playoff experience for me, just because I was doing it remotely from home. It's not the same thing. The playoffs are a totally different beast. It's like you walk into the locker room and you just see like half these reporters are people you've never seen in your life before, right? Because obviously, as the playoffs start, especially in Vancouver, it being a fairly big market, I guess a lot of people that don't cover in the regular season, a lot of outlets are like, okay, go and cover the team. And so it's a totally different setup. I feel like in the regular season, you get an opportunity to you can basically talk to whoever you want, whenever you want. You can get it done in a one-on-one setting, whereas the playoffs is it's regular and normal to have a scrum with just 20, 30 people. It's something I'd never really experienced before. So to go through that, and even just the volume of games and travel, plus knowing how high the stakes are, the intensity, some of the magical moments like game three or four, I can't remember which one, where the Canucks had the wild comeback victory, Elias Lindholm scores an OT. It's magical, it's wild, it's crazy. Everything moves at a million miles an hour. It's one of a kind.
What happens for you when a game like that? I think it was game four of the first round where the Canucks are down late in the game, and your story is how the Canucks failed, and then in an instant things change. Like, how difficult is that for you? What's that night like for a journalist, especially when it's a high stakes playoff game, to change the complete narrative of your story?
Yeah, you have to adapt really quickly. It's also funny because it wasn't just that they were down two goals with more than 2 minutes left. It was also the fact that Nashville had spent most of that third period in Vancouver's end when they were the ones holding the lead. So there was nothing in the lead up to those last 3 minutes or so that made you think, oh, the Canucks have a chance of actually pushing there, because they'd been so lifeless for most of the game. The first one goes in, and immediately you're thinking, at least you're in your mind, okay, I've got to prepare for the possibility that this could change. But the benefit there is, because they tied it up, you had the OT intermission to rewire things, and the format that we had at the Athletic was sort of like a five takeaways that I was doing with my colleague Thomas Drant. So a lot of those takeaways and main points still translated. It was more reworking the tone, the lead, obviously the conclusion. And so we got to work on that in the OT. And in fact, we drafted a couple of different leads, one for a Vancouver one for a Nashville one. And so we were ready with that, so that as soon as Elias Lindholm scored, we already had a lead ready, and bang, we filed it within like 30 seconds of the goal, straight down in the locker room. It was crazy, but at the same time, it was a good experience for just thinking on your feet and being ready for narrative changes.
This might be a bit of inside baseball, but what's it like to work with Dranser day in and day out for the Athletic?
It's awesome. He is the best teammate I could ask for. We're so collaborative. We see the game in a very similar way. That's the biggest thing is, we never have radically different takes, it seems like. And because of that, we can work together so well on so many different pieces. We're both analytical. We both like to go deep on things. So it's an absolute blast. And I mean, working with him through this playoff run was definitely a huge treat.
I'm really curious. Just like you're from Vancouver, and I'm sure 2011. You know, me and you were young kids at the time, and remember that. I remember 2011 very vividly as a kid. But What was it like just to be in the building in Vancouver and just see all the towels and just the atmosphere for those playoff games after really it being, I think, since 2015 that they had
Yeah.
the playoffs in Vancouver? Obviously, they had made it in the bubble. What was just that experience like for you?
Something I had never experienced before, to be totally honest with you. I'd gone to playoff games, I believe, in 2013 as a kid, back when I was a fan with my dad, and that was really special. But nothing compared to game one, round one against Nashville, where all that pent-up energy of, hey, it's been 9 years since the Canucks have hosted a playoff game in this city. It was electric. It's hard to put into words because the bar that it set, I covered games in Nashville, Edmonton, even the home games, on like game seven, round two, right? And nothing in Vancouver, same building, but nothing compared to game one, round one. We're just all that anticipation, all that pent-up energy made for an experience like I can't even put into words how loud it was. Players after the game were talking about how emotional it made them feel in the lead up to the pregame. How many of them were choking up? How many of them were tearing up? You had to be there. And to this day, it's one of the highlights of my career.
Do you think after this run and just talking about the fans that maybe in a sense, the doom and gloom and pessimism of Canucks fans has changed at all in Canucks Twitter, or is there some light at the end of the tunnel, or do you think it's still going to be some murky ground until the Canucks consistently are a playoff team and have consistent success in the playoffs? I'm just kind of curious your take of knowing the fan base so well and also knowing the Canucks fan base a little bit as well.
Well, there's always going to be cynicism, right? This is a team that hasn't won a cup before. Fans are used to heartbreak. So I think Canucks fans are always prepared mentally for things to go wrong. But at the same time, I really think this was the season where the city fell in love with the team again. The diehards are always going to be there. They were there through thick and thin. But in terms of the city as a whole, casual fans, a lot of casual fans becoming diehards. That conversion was extremely special to watch this season. I mean, I remember in years past, I'd have maybe a couple of my friends were what I'd consider really closely following the team in terms of watching most of the games and really keeping up with the roster. Now, this season, it felt like everybody was on board. People who and I think in Vancouver, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but the majority of people that I knew were at least in some capacity Canucks fans in 2011. Even if they didn't consistently watch games, they knew the core like Luongo, Burrows, Kessler, the Sedins, Bieksa. But in the last few years, it felt like unless you actually follow the team closely, people didn't really know who Pettersson, Miller, Hughes, Demko, guys like that were. But now I feel like we finally crossed that territory where, okay, people are on board with this again. And my Instagram story on Canucks game days, how many people that I wouldn't have even looked at as quote unquote Canucks fans, but when Vancouver was playing in Edmonton, for example, and the Canucks hosted a watch party at home at Rogers Arena, just to see all the Instagram stories of people who'd bought tickets to go, I'm like, wow, this is crazy. I didn't know you cared about the Canucks. So that was really illuminating for me, just because I thought maybe no team will ever capture the city's imagination like the 2011 one did again. And yet, I think this season just goes to show that there's always going to be an appetite for a Canucks team that's actually good.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious where you see this team at now, and there's a lot of questions, and you've written about that too. There's a lot of UFAs, decisions on some RFAs as well. How close is this team to being able to retain the level that they had this season, and like how probable is that in your mind that this team can almost run it back, as they say, and maybe not with the same auxiliary players, but still get to, make the playoffs, be a good, consistent playoff team like they were this year?
It's possible, but it's going to be challenging, right? I, for example, to repeat 50 wins, winning the division, that's going to be, I think, difficult to replicate in terms of actually getting back to the playoffs. I think that's definitely a lot more realistic of a bar. The main issue is, of course, they have so many pending UFAs. Guys like Elias Lindholm, Nikita Zadorov, they really only have three defensemen signed right now: Quinn Hughes, Carson Soucy, and Noah Juulsen. They've got their entire right side of the blue line to sort of rebuild. Filip Pronek is an RFA. They have to contend with Elias Pettersson's new extension kicking in. They're not going to be able to keep the same caliber of team cap wise, right? The goal right now is they're going to have to become more efficient in the sense that they don't. If they had to bring the same team back, they'd be over the cap, right? Like, it's literally not possible. So you have to become more efficient from a financial perspective and better at the same time, right? Right? That's the goal of this offseason, which is the most difficult thing to do for any team in the NHL. Now, with that said, they do have, although they have a lot of key roster holes, there is an opportunity in the sense of how much cap space they still have. Once you account for Tucker Pullman on LTIR, they do have more than 25 million, so they do have the capacity to go out and, let's say, chase a big name top line winger for Elias Pettersson, for example, which was a major need this season. It's just about you're going to have to hit on basically every offseason bet you make, which is really challenging. But hey, that's what kind of what they did last offseason, where they had, for just under $10 million, they brought in Carson Soucy, Teddy Bluger, Ian Cole, Pia Suter, nailed it out of the park with every single one of those guys. It's obviously tougher when you have to do the same thing, but now you've got to do it with some of your big swing players as well. We'll see. I mean, it's really hard to assess where exactly this team is going to be come October when they have so many question marks on the roster right now.
You look at other teams around the league, maybe even like the Tampa Bay's, where they lose those players that are on the periphery, but then they still maintain themselves as playoff teams just because of how good this core their core is. Do you think that's maybe the case here with the Canucks, where if you have a Hughes, a Demko, if he's healthy, I guess Seelovs now too, you can throw him in there, and Elias Pettersson, that is good enough to get you close enough to the playoffs, even if you don't hit every offseason move out of the park.
You'd hope so. You're going to need to stay healthy is a massive part of that, because last season or this past season, it wasn't just like every player outside of Demko down the stretch was healthy, which notably included Brock Besser, who has struggled to stay healthy, but also B, so many of these guys had career years, right? Like, Quinn Hughes is probably going to win the Norris Trophy this year. JT Miller crossed 100 points for the first time in his career. Brock Besser scored 40 goals. Even up and down the lineup, I mean, I know Dakota Joshua was a pending UFA, but he had a career year. Connor Garland had arguably the best season he's ever had as a Vancouver Canuck. Not necessarily point-wise, but in terms of a play-driving engine and overall value to this team. Nils Höglander had 24 goals just at 5-on-5 alone. So we'll see whether some of those seasons can be repeated, both from a health standpoint and even from a performance standpoint.
When you talk about the free agents, there's so many to talk about. You just wrote about Elias Lindholm, and maybe just the likelihood that he returns and what that next contract for him looks like. Maybe just talk about that article that you wrote, I think, today, and maybe just expand about on it. Sorry.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of risks for the Canucks if they're considering a Lindholm extension, even though he was remarkably valuable in the playoffs as a sort of monster two-way piece, played an important checking role, took a ton of D-zone starts, valuable in the PK, scored 10 points in 13 games. There are a lot of red flags here. The first is that there's such a weak UFA market this year for centermen. There isn't a single 60-plus point center this season. And not that centers that are hitting the market have never hit 60-plus points, but this past season they didn't hit 60 points or more. And even if you expand the criteria to include guys who scored more than 30 points this season, it's only a handful of centermen. And it's guys like Lasse Lindholm, Sean Monahan, Max Domi, Chandler Stephenson, Jack Roslovic. All of those guys have question marks somewhere. Because of that, Lindholm is far and away going to be the top target. I worry that he's going to get overpaid, that he's going to clock in at the $7-8 million AAV range on a long-term deal, especially when you consider how in recent seasons Tomas Hertl and Bo Horvat commanded over $8 million on long-term deals, despite, yeah, those guys were good centermen, but they weren't no questions asked on a contending team. You're a first-line caliber pivot. So I worry about just him, Lindholm, pricing himself in a range where it's not just sometimes when you sign a contract in for agency, you worry about the back half of the deal. With Lindholm, it's can he live up to it in year one even, right? So especially because of his declining offensive impact. This is a player who in the regular season had the same number of 5-on-5 points as Sam Lafferty and Danny Bluger. Ilya Mikheyev, who every Canucks fan is totally fed up with, remarkably had 7 5-on-5 points more than Elias Lindholm. Even in the playoffs, Lindholm benefited from some bounces. He played well, but he also got the breaks when he needed them, in the sense that his line shot over 16% at 5-on-5, more than double his regular season career average. Individually, he shot 20%. And so that skews some of his offensive numbers in the playoffs. I really worry about him as an offensive driver. I have all the faith in the world that he can be an excellent defensive guy, but I'm not sure he can live up to a $7-8 million AAV from an offensive standpoint. And if you're the Canucks, when I examine their cap situation, they can really only afford to purchase one expensive, lucrative forward contract given their needs on the back end. And that's where, if you're talking about committing $7-8 million to a forward via free agency or trade, I would so much rather prefer allocating those dollars to finding the right winger for Elias Pettersson rather than another centerman. Because you look around the NHL, there wasn't a single team this past season that had three centermen making $7 million or more on the roster.
With that, is there any, like, covering this team so well and maybe hearing things as well, is there anyone that you think the Canucks are eyeing, just maybe in free agency or via the trade route, to maybe add to their forward group in terms of that flashy winger that they might bring in?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be interested in Jake Gensel if he hits the market on July 1st. On the trade market, I would expect them to be interested in Martin Natchez. Outside of that, we'll kind of have to see how things progress, right? I'll be fascinated to see if they have any interest in Nick Ehlers. If Travis Konecny contract negotiations go sideways, could he be a player that hits the market? Pavel Buchnevich in St. Louis. Put it this way, if there's a dynamic, creative, high-end top six winger, I expect the Canucks to be interested.
That's a that makes a lot of sense. One player that did very well but also slipped a bit to end the season for the Canucks was Filip Hronek. He might have a big payday. It seems as though probably with the Canucks, just because he is an RFA. Where do you see that those two sides in terms of getting a deal done this summer, and what type of deal do you expect the two to agree to? Is this a lengthy deal in the $7-8 million market, and would that be the right type of deal for the Canucks?
Yeah, I mean, you could spend an entire podcast on its own just discussing all the factors involved in the Hronek situation here. I think for starters, we all, most of us in Vancouver know, he's got strong leverage because of his counting stats, how many points he put up, his top pair ice time, most notably him having arbitration rights and only being a year away from unrestricted free agency. He has a tremendous negotiating position here. So even though a lot of Canucks fans may look at him and say, we don't think his intrinsic value is, let's say, $8 million on a long-term deal, Philip Hronek can approach this summer with an ask in and around that range for a long-term deal, just because he's got the power of saying, hey, well, if you're not going to pay me that type of number on a long-term deal, I'll just take my 1 year arbitration award, walk myself to free agency, and now I can sign anywhere for a high dollar in term amount on the open market. So that's why the Canucks have a tough negotiating position here, especially given how much they surrendered to acquire him in the first place. Now, a lot of Canucks fans, let me backtrack for a second. $8 million in a long-term deal, Hronek is not worth that intrinsically, right? Point blank and period. We see how he faded down the stretch, although it was reported by Dan Murphy that he was playing through an injury, so that's important context. But even if that hadn't happened injury-wise, he is not sturdy enough. He is not a dynamic enough play driver on his own to warrant an $8 million payday. With that said, a lot of Canucks fans, I think, have swung too far in the other direction where they think he's so easily discardable, that there's a recency of bias about his play down the stretch and into the playoffs, where they say just flip him for a haul, find someone else in free agency. I don't think it's as easy as that narrative makes it sound. For starters, I don't even know what Hronek's trade value is, genuinely, because yeah, he's a valuable top pair right shot defenseman, but if he's looking for $8 million on a long-term deal, how many teams is that contract going to scare off? Because if I was a team with a need on the right side of my blue line, I'd be interested in Philip Hronek the player, but I'm not interested in Philip Hronek the contract. And so I wouldn't be pushing aggressively for Hronek if he was available on the trade market. How many teams are going to think in a similar vein? So then you get into the territory of, okay, just how restrained would his trade value be? If his trade value is restrained, would you even be better off trying to explore, as crazy as this sounds, like a 1 year deal and just kick the can down the road, and add another year of information to your disposal to know just how valuable is he to this blue line? Because I think Canucks fans forget just how valuable he was for the Canucks in the regular season. I remember doing a national piece at the end of February, breaking down the NHL's best and worst top pairs. Vancouver's top pair had the best goal differential in the NHL. It wasn't just that they were one of the top first pairs in the NHL. They were the best in terms of 5-on-5 goal differential, and that wasn't just all Quinn Hughes. You talked to Quinn Hughes himself. He has straight up said that Hronek is the best D partner Hronek has ever had, and or that Hughes has ever had. And it's not, yeah, the last couple of years Hughes hasn't had great D partners, but Chris Tanev is part of that equation as well. Hughes loves Tanev. It speaks volumes that Hronek is placed ahead of Tanev in that sort of hierarchy. Plus, for all the people saying just sign a Tanev or a Matt Roy in free agency, doesn't quite work the same way, because this Canucks team, they are so good defensively. What they lack right now, from the All-Star break to the end of the regular season, playoffs onward, was scoring ability. In the first half of the season, they were just kind of riding a PDO bender. They needed a second dynamic offensive piece. You move Hronek away and bring in a defensive defenseman, it's not going to be the same thing. You're going to struggle to create offense from the back end. It's not only what Hronek brought to the table individually in terms of his point totals, but now Quinn Hughes doesn't have as many offensive touches. He doesn't have somebody that can build the same level of chemistry, that has the playmaking, that has the shot. So your best offensive blue liner now is restrained from an offensive standpoint. Like, that is for a Canucks team that struggled to score goals down the stretch and into the playoffs, that is a legit question mark. So I'm not sure what the best route here is in dealing with Hronek, but you're going to have to just explore what his trade value is. You're going to have to explore what are your alternatives for replacing him in terms of another offensive defenseman if you want to go down that route. Again, I think it's even conceivable that you consider taking a 1-year deal and kicking the can down the road. Of course, it'd be nicer to do something like 7 million times 2 or 3 years, but if you're in Hronek's shoes, why would you sign that deal when you could just take your 1-year ARB award and walk yourself straight to free agency, right? So it's a situation that's still developing, and I'm curious to see how it unfolds.
Yeah, being here in Ottawa, we've missed a top line right shot defenseman. So I feel as though it's, beggars can't be choosers sometimes with things like this. But it'll be really interesting to see what the Canucks do. And along that, like you talk about like the defensive role of this team. Is that something where, for years the Canucks leaked goals, and now under Rick Tocchet, this season they were one of the best defensive teams in the league. How much of that do you think was coaching versus the personnel in your mind?
It was both because they brought in pieces like Soucy, Bluger, Cole, Suter that are terrific defensively. And on top of that, Tocchet really changed up the habits. And yes, there were some X's and O's, but also from a mindset perspective, offensive zone turnovers are a non-negotiable. This Canucks team doesn't create a ton off the rush, which means that if you're going to be more conservative managing the puck, you're not going to turn it over at the offensive blue line. You're not going to make the types of mistakes that lead to odd man rushes against. So, really, in 1 year, they went from one of the worst rush defensive teams in the NHL to one of the best, which is almost unfathomable. Like, it was it's wild, and it's why Tocchet fully deserved that Jack Adams. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say it's a mix. The players had to buy in. To see guys like JT Miller take that step, go from under Bruce Boudreau towards the end there, he was a whipping boy for his defensive habits, and now he's a matchup center that the club relies on to go toe to toe with Connor McDavid, and he can absolutely hold his own in that type of a daunting role. So again, I'd say it's a bit of a mix. To go back to the end there, when you were mentioning Ottawa and maybe needing a right shot defenseman, just kind of curious, just spitballing. Hey, if the Canucks need a top six winger, and they're willing to give up a Philip Peronic, would the Sens have an appetite to potentially part ways with a Jake or Drake Batherson, for example, or is he sort of off limits?
That's really, I know Drake pretty well covering the Sens. I'd say I think that would make a lot of sense for both sides. I do think what you talked about is that number, right? And the Sens don't
Yeah.
have a lot of cap space. So, and does Hronek want to come to Ottawa? I don't know. But that does make a lot of sense for both sides. The problem with Drake Batherson, why the Canucks would want him, is that he's on a really good deal.
Yeah.
Sens don't have a lot of really good deals. I think he's making just like 4.95 million or
Yeah.
something for 3 more years. But if you're Steve Staios, Batherson isn't a good defensive player. He's what was one of the clubhouse leaders in the minus category the past couple of years. But he's absolutely skilled. I think him and Elias Pettersson would make a lot of magic out there on the ice. So that would be a really interesting trade. And if I was the Sens, I'd think about it. But if Hronek's asking for 8 times 8, I don't know if that makes enough sense.
Yeah.
They have Sanderson and Shabbat making 8 million, but if it's, let's say, I don't know, 6 times 7, I don't know. I'm just,
Yeah.
it'd be an
It's
interesting.
this is why the contract is such a potential impediment, because player for player, maybe it's not 1-to-1 fair, but it's close. It makes both sides think a little bit, but Then you weigh Hronek's potential asking. And I'll be honest, if I was in Ottawa's shoes, I wouldn't do that deal. Just because Batherson's on a great deal and Hronek is if he's asking for 8 million, I'd be like, see ya, right? So this is why the Canucks are in a bit of a pickle here.
Yeah, it's tough because you just don't know what. I mean, I feel like the Jake Gensel thing would make just so much sense, but it's so hard. I guess the going off that, because here in Ottawa, just keeping with the Ottawa theme, a lot of people have talked about Dakota Joshua and how good he was. Is what do you think he can stay in Vancouver this summer? Has he played too well to kind of price himself out of return? Because it sounded like he wanted to return, but money is money, I guess.
I think he's a 50-50 right now. He is such a unique player type because he's so big, he's so physical, he's such an effective force on the forecheck. He of course brought valuable secondary scoring, was probably going to hit 20 goals and 40 points if he stayed healthy this season. Plus he's reliable defensively, wins a lot of battles. You can trust him on the penalty kill. He is such an all-around unique player type that he is so valuable for not only the Canucks but for a lot of teams if he hits the open market. But on the other hand, it has to be at the right price point, right? Because you also have to weigh in that he shot around 21% this past season. So can he maintain what he did offensively? Because I think he's got skill. He's not just a plug that got super lucky and scored all these goals. He has legit hands around the net. He knows how to get open. He's a smart player. He read off Connor Garland really well. They had special chemistry in the offensive zone. Their underlying numbers as a line were outstanding. Again, I think Garland's the main driver for that. But in the regular season, this is a third line that was controlling like 57, 58% of expected goals. It was ridiculous. It wasn't just that they were scoring and it's completely unsustainable. It's They were one of the best third lines in the NHL, and Joshua was an important part of that. That said, what's the cap it going to be? What's the term going to be? Is he going to be asking for over 3 million on a medium term deal? That's the point where you maybe think that the price point is prohibitive if you're in the Canucks shoes. And Patrick Alvin at the end of the season did say that they're going to need to be confident in their pro scouting staff that they can find the next Dakota Joshua. So I think the Canucks will have a line in the sand. They will have a firm walkaway point. This isn't a player that they're going to be overly loyal to. But in having said that, he was such a unique fit and such a great asset alongside Garland on the third line that if you can get him maybe a hair under 3 million, then you absolutely consider it, I think, if you're Vancouver.
Just going back maybe to the playoffs a little bit, and players that maybe underperformed a little bit was Elias Pettersson. And I know he talked about being injured, I think, since the All-Star break, and you can kind of see the trend of his production going down by that time. But you look around the league and it seems like Connor McDavid's banged up. There's so many players in the playoffs right now still excelling yet being banged up. How much do you think his struggles were purely about just having a couple ailments, and how much is maybe a mental? Because it does feel as though just watching him in pressers and on the ice, he seems to wear his heart on his sleeve. And when things aren't going well, you can really see it in his face and reaction. Where do you see it just being around him day in and day out throughout the playoffs and the season?
I think it's both because watching him play from January onward, you did notice that, okay, he's missing that dynamic pop in his first step. He's having difficulty manufacturing space for himself in the neutral zone, even in the offensive zone, from starts to stops to beat defenders one-on-one. He just didn't have that explosive pop in his first step. And not that he's the fastest player in a straight line, but sometimes you need that extra little jump to create space for yourself in high traffic situations, get to the inside. That was definitely missing, and I do think that was likely injury related, but there were also parts of this game that maybe didn't have anything to do with the knee injury. His decision making sometimes in the playoffs. For instance, he was passing up a lot of prime shooting opportunities, or didn't have as much zip on his wrist shot, was missing open nets that he doesn't normally miss. That's probably more between his ears than it is with his injury. So it's probably both, and this is going to be hopefully a nice offseason for him to just reset. He already dealt with the contract. Don't have to deal with that anymore. This is going to be an opportunity for him to just kind of exhale, get away from hockey a little bit, take some stress off his mind, because hey, starting next season, he is going to have a ton of pressure on him again, just because of the $11.6 million cap hit that he's on. And if and when the Canucks do make the playoffs next spring, given how much he struggled this past spring, he's going to have heat on him. He's going to have the spotlight to produce and be a game breaker.
I guess just with that, and maybe I know you've written about the contract, but just now, heading into the first year of that contract, do you think it was the like how good did Rutherford and Alvin do to get him at that cap hit? Is that the right type of cap hit? Are you worried about the contract after his playoffs? Just maybe walk us through where you see the contract right now as we sit here today in the off season.
Well, it was only a hair over Nylander's 11 and a half. And when you value in Pettersson's plays a premium position as a centerman, plus he had a 100-plus point season already in his back pocket before negotiating that deal, which Nylander didn't. I think the Canucks did fairly well. I thought that number would be closer to a flat 12, for example, somewhere in between Nylander's sort of 11 and a half. I looked at that as kind of the floor, and 12.6 for MacKinnon would obviously have been like he's obviously not getting MacKinnon's number, right? So I thought the Canucks did fairly well in that to get that number at that price, especially considering the cap is going to rise. And sure, heading into next season, he's going to be one of the highest paid centermen in the NHL, but that's going to change over the course of an 8-year deal. He's going to each year move further and further and further down that list of highest paid players in the NHL. Also, put it this way, he had 89 points in what was considered a down season for him, right? Like that speaks to how he's a hell of a player. And heading into the All-Star break, he was on pace for 47 goals and 107 points. I think there's a recency bias where we forget just how dominant he was in the first half of the season. How he was that game breaker. And I don't think it's a coincidence that his production fell off a cliff after he started to deal with that knee issue. So I'm not worried about that contract. It's, of course, going to be a lot to live up to, but I'm not staying up at night thinking about it.
Quinn Hughes, for his standards, might have had a bit of a down playoffs. Like, do you think his game translates as well as it does to regular season hockey to playoff hockey? Was he banged up? Just, obviously he played well, but maybe not to the Norris Trophy caliber that he did throughout the regular season.
Yeah, I think he was quite visibly banged up, even if he wouldn't admit it. Although he wasn't quite a game breaker in terms of his individual scoring like he was in the regular season, he still was by far the Canucks' best defenseman. The play driving numbers were outstanding, how he controls games. He was, put it this way, he was the only defenseman with which the Canucks as a team generated any semblance of offense on the ice with. Even if he wasn't the one scoring, the drop off with when he was on the bench compared to when he was on the ice offensively, in terms of the on ice numbers, how many shots are the Canucks generating, how many chances, night and day, night and day. So even though he was banged up and maybe wasn't taking games over the way he did in the regular season, he was still tilting the ice. He was still a critical play driver. And in the Edmonton series, for example, I think he was only on the ice for like two goals against at 5-on-5 the entire series, right? So still an impactful player, still a bona fide number one defenseman.
I guess just moving off on from that, I guess when you look back at this season, how much credit does just and maybe what have you seen that maybe the differences between the Jim Benning era and everything that went on behind the scenes, and now the Rutherford and Alvin era. Because, I talking to you a little bit about Travis Green, which obviously I care about here in Ottawa. He dealt with a lot of dysfunction. What have you seen maybe behind the scenes between the differences in those two GM and administrations, and in a sense, how have you just liked their moves so far in the 2 and a bit years that they've been in charge?
Oh boy, where do I even start? I think the biggest thing is pro decisions with respect to trades and free agency. I mean, Jim Benning routinely hampered this team with anchor contracts. He routinely overpaid for guys. Whereas this management regime, outside of maybe the Ilya Mikheyev contract, have been relatively spotless with who they've targeted to upgrade this team. And that's been the biggest difference, right? The core guys, yes, they have also leveled up under Alvin. That's a critical part of this team's evolution, no doubt about it. But the supporting cast around the core is also night and day. And that comes down to how much more efficiently Alvin and Rutherford have allocated their remaining dollars to that supporting cast, filling out the blue line, finding the right coach and bringing in the right defensive identity. It's again, I look back at the Jim Benning regime and you almost just sometimes laugh and wonder how they were in charge for so long. Whereas with Alvin and Rutherford, you're like, okay, this is what it's like to have a professional show, to have experienced, and I know Alvin's first time GM, but to have Jim Rutherford at the top, to have experienced vets sort of leading the way, this is what it should be like.
I feel that with the Sens from transitioning from the Melnyk era to the Andauer era, there's a lot of changes slowly seeping in behind the scenes that it sounds like maybe there has been in Vancouver. Before I let you go, I think I have to talk about the Seelov show that you experienced throughout the playoffs, and just what's next for the Canucks in terms of their goaltending. Are you worried about Demko and just his injury history because he has been so banged up the past couple of years? Just what do you make of Seelov's and just that playoff run that he went to? Do you think that's sustainable at all in terms of heading into next season?
Yeah, for sure. I think he has proven that he has legit promise and should play some NHL games next season, whether it's as a full-time backup or whether he's more of like a number three and because he's waiver exempt, sort of moving up and down between the NHL and AHL to make sure that he plays as many games as possible for his development. I'm not sure the exact road that they go down, but he absolutely, in some capacity, should be part of the goaltending rotation at the NHL level. This coming season, he was terrific, unflappable, the demeanor. I know his raw save percentage, for example, may not have lit the world up, but he outdueled UC Saros from games 4 to 6. And in the Edmonton series, going up against Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, when he had barely experienced NHL action in the first place, for him to give the Canucks a chance to win in every single game was outstanding. Put it this way, there wasn't a single game where you would point to the goaltending and say that cost the Canucks that game. And even in, for example, game six of the Edmonton series, where it was maybe a rough outing for him, the team in front laid an egg, right? Like the team in front was the bigger problem than the goaltending. So he was impressive from that standpoint, just the level of competency he gave with sparks of, okay, wow, he's actually bailing the Canucks out in moments as well. On top of that, for him to bounce back whenever he had a shaky start, game one against Edmonton, not the best start for him. The Canucks still found a way to win. In game two, it was the Leon Draisaitl, Connor McDavid show. Seelov was the only reason the Canucks got to overtime in that game. He was outstanding. In game seven of round two, he made three 10 bell potential save of the playoffs stops. So again, him bouncing back, I think those are great mental attributes for a goalie to have, and he's going to be an important part of this club, not only next season but moving forward, because yeah, Demko's Durability is a question mark right now. They have to find a way to cap his starts for next season, I think, and do whatever it takes to make sure that he's healthy and fresh heading into the playoffs.
Is there any chance that it's a bit of a 1A, 1B type, or is it still that Thatcher Demko's cemented as the starter? Like, I know it's a small sample size and just the playoffs with Seelos, but is there any bit of that maybe going into next season?
Demko is the clear starter, but you don't want to run him back for 60 starts. It's really that simple. And again, I don't know if the Canucks find another veteran so that it's more of a three goalie system. But in some capacity, like I don't want to see Demko eclipsing 50 starts if he's healthy. Like he should not be playing like a workhorse. Keeping him fresh and healthy again for the playoffs has to be a priority. And so talent-wise, ability-wise, he's the clear starter, but the workload needs to be more evenly distributed.
Before I let you go, I just have a more philosophical question for you, just as someone that's so analytically, sees the game through that lens. What's it like for you when you're looking through data for the playoffs when it's such a short sample size? Is there anything that you look at particularly in terms of analytics or stats that kind of can take a step back from the short sample size? Like, what do you look at typically, just as someone who's kind of interested in where you see the game during the playoffs?
I don't lean on data as much just because, again, small samples. I think you get a better feel for it watching the flow of the game. But with that said, I love to look at the head-to-head matchups in a series. Matchups matter more in the playoffs, and so looking at in various series which shutdown center is going up against the other team's best players. Which D pair is getting the McDavid matchup? Which D pair is getting the Draisaitl matchup? What are the results in that situation? Who's being sheltered? Who has an opportunity against, in for example, in the playoffs, why there was so much heat on Pettersson wasn't just Hayes not producing, it's that he got third line matchups as a result of Lindholm being able to take tougher defensive assignments. So it's a lot of looking at matchups, having that head-to-head data and results. That's what I love to look at data, particularly for in the playoffs. It's not the only way I use statistics in the postseason, but it's way further amplified compared to compared to the regular season.
When you analyze players specifically, do you see it as almost because in many ways playoff hockey is so much different from regular season hockey that you see a dichotomy that maybe a Dakota Joshua, I mean, he had a great regular season as well, but he's a better player in the playoffs because of the way the game's officiated, the physicality. Like, do you see it that way almost, how you look at players differently between the regular season and playoffs?
That's a great question. I think you have to be careful that you don't get fooled by small samples, right? It could just be a guy has a bad playoff run, not because he's quote unquote not built for playoff hockey, but just because he's struggling in a given stretch and it just happened to be at the worst time of year. It's easy to look at a player like JT Miller, for example, earlier in his career, and of course he was in a less prominent role when he was with the Rangers and the Lightning, but he was never really a dynamite playoff producer. He struggled, in fact, to produce in the playoffs until he got to Vancouver, right? So sometimes it just takes guys time to develop and find the right footing. But on the other hand, sometimes when you see repeated playoff performances, you do stumble into players that are maybe just not built for the moment, right? Mitch Marner in Toronto is an example.
Ask.
If it happens time after time after time again, okay, there's clearly something there, right? And on the flip side, there are sometimes players that their game is like a Nikita Zadorov, for example. I know I've only seen him in a playoff environment once, and maybe he doesn't repeat it to the same degree, but there's an example of a guy that's more valuable in the postseason than he is in the regular season because how physically he is, how he defends in front of the net, even just the game within the game. So yes, there is a dichotomy between regular season and playoffs and which players can sometimes be more effective, but you've got to be careful not to fall into the trap of drawing conclusions too quickly.
Well, Thanks so much for doing this. And before I let you go, I just want to ask you my one last question about the Canucks, because I know we've been doing this for a long time, and I'm sure we could spend more and more time talking Canucks. But what are the expectations for next season? Is it playoffs or bust? Is it cup or bust? Maybe not cup or bust, just looking at your reaction, but what do you think the expectations are for the Canucks this offseason or heading into next season?
Honestly, it is so difficult to say without knowing what to get accomplished in the summer. I don't know. Like this team, yeah, you want them to take the next step, and the hope is that they can be a consistent cup contender, but they're gonna have a tough time with their cap situation, and we're just going to I think we're gonna have a much better idea at the end of August. Looking at the team on paper and saying, okay, this is what the team can reasonably expect to do. So I'm going to hold off on judgment, but put it this way, I'm not expecting a drop off like the after the Canucks made the bubble playoffs in 2020, had that run, and the next season they're finishing at the bottom of their division. Like it'd be a catastrophic disappointment if the team doesn't make the playoffs. I think at a baseline level, they need to be a playoff team. But within that range, are they more of just a fringe playoff team? Or are they a team that can actually do damage in the playoffs? That's where there's a lot of room for variance based on the moves that they make this summer.
So it sounds like you think they can be this kind of playoff caliber team for years to come, Harmon. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Hopefully, yeah. I think that that has to be the expectation, right? You look at Quinn Hughes, the value contract that he's on for the next 3 years. That's the window to do some damage in the playoffs, and that's your window to win a Stanley Cup. So, yeah, you kind of have to. This has to be the window.
Well, I hope that you have more memorable moments out in Vancouver watching playoff games. Maybe you'd even go to a finals, reenact 2011, except this time win the game seven, stuff like that. Thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. I love your work. You cover the Canucks like no one else. Is there anything else you want to, plug for, your work at The Athletic, your podcast, anything?
Yeah, nothing much. Just of course my writings at The Athletic, and Canucks Conversation is the podcast that David Quadrelli and I do. So that's always a ton of fun.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Harmon, for taking the time and doing this. Enjoy your, I'm sure, busy off season with a lot of things happening in Canucks land.
Thanks, Alex.